We begin with the far grimmer Monday this represents for the people of Iraq. New gains on the ground for Sunni militants, government and Shiite forces allied on the ground north of Baghdad trying to prevent the militants from pushing further south. The town of Tal Afar has fallen into the hands of the forces of ISIS, or ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or Iraq and the Levant, which refers to the more ancient territory of Syria and eastern Lebanon. We begin with veteran journalist Christiane Amanpour, chief international correspondent for CNN. Christiane, welcome to the program.
Hello, John.
So how do you see this juggernaut of Sunni militants and ISIS, or ISIL, whatever you want to call it, heading towards Baghdad at this point?
Well, that is really the big question. Will they be able to do the same kind of thing in Baghdad that they've done in Mosul and the other areas that you've just mentioned? I think what is absolutely clear from all the interviews I've done over this and all the reporting over the last several weeks, frankly, is that this is very possibly the end of Iraq as we know it. Even if ISIS does not capture Baghdad, and remember, Baghdad is a massive city, anywhere between 7 to 9 million inhabitants and mostly Shiite, and it would obviously be very heavily defended, unlike the others that ISIS has rolled over. But what seems to be happening is that there will be a de facto partition. The Kurds in the north, ISIS-controlled territory to the west of that, including al-Anbar, the famous Sunni heartland, and then a Shiite big state down from Baghdad to the south, encompassing all the majority Shiite areas and the Shiite shrine cities. This is perhaps what most people think is going to happen, because they've been believe that it's going to be incredibly difficult to push ISIS back from what it has already captured.
And you push them back into Syria, which they already control. If you look at the strategic situation on the ground in Syria, you've got tremendous instability around a fragilely defended Damascus. ISIS seems to be pretty good at getting that situation in Syria. Are they duplicating it in Iraq?
Well, let's just get the lay of the land straight here. What has happened, if you remember very well, is that when ISIS's precursor, the Al-Qaeda in Iraq, had really wrecked Iraq, particularly the West, and the place was in a massive civil war, President Bush and General Petraeus ordered a surge, and that defeated these people. But it also was political. They had the Sunni tribes on track. When President Obama pulled the U.S. troops out, this started to go to hell again in a handbasket. We've been reporting for years since the end of the U.S. troops on violence and IEDs and suicide bombings all over Iraq for several years now. But add to that the chaos in Syria, and that is what has really enabled ISIS to move back and forth against porous borders and to create and plan what it said it would do, which is to try to create a caliphate in that area of the Levant, of Syria, Iraq, and they would love to do it in Lebanon as well. Syria has been left to fester, and therefore these Islamic jihadi groups have been allowed to do their planning, do their training, equipping, and moving in and out and across borders. So there's two very, very big priorities right now. It is a state of desperate urgency to try to hold the ISIS advance. If the United States, not boots on the ground, but if the U.S. can bolster Iraqi forces, if Iran and the U.S. manage to have some kind of tactical alliance in order to do that, is one thing. The other thing of equal importance and urgency is to recreate a government of national unity in Iraq. Maliki cannot do it on his own. He is sectarian, authoritarian, and he's viewed as really sort of like a Shiite dictator right now.
It seems to me, though, that why didn't Petraeus and the outcome of the surge leave in place some assurance that there would be a political alliance with the Sunni power base in Anbar province after the U.S. forces left? It seems as though that wasn't even considered, and Nouri al-Maliki just basically said, okay, the U.S. is gone. You guys are done.
Well, you'll hear a lot of argument and playing the blame game over that. There are those who believe that the reason a residual U.S. force wasn't left in Iraq is because Nouri al-Maliki's government said no, And Iran said no, and the U.S. didn't try very hard. Whatever happened, they did not create what most military commanders said had to happen, and that was to keep a residual U.S. force in there to train and to keep training and equipping and planning with Iraqi forces. Plus, and this is crucial, to have leverage with the Iraqi politicians. Former Ambassador Ryan Crocker has said that these people almost never got along. There were always arguments, and this is a nascent attempt at coming out of a dictatorship. What they needed was a third party to play the honest broker and to mediate. The United States was that. But when it withdrew its forces, it then didn't have any leverage. And therefore, over the last several years, Maliki has been able to simply shunt out the Sunnis and create a Shia-dominated leadership. And I spoke to former Iraqi Prime Minister Ayad Alawi as Mosul was being taken, and he told me that why did the Iraqi division simply collapse and run, turn and flee in the face of ISIS? Because, and these are his words, they had nothing to fight for. Imagine what that means. They feel they had nothing to fight for. They were not enfranchised, these military forces. And that is a very big problem that has to be sorted out. But the immediate problem is to try to hold the line, not let ISIS advance any further, and then somehow try to create a coalition that can attempt to push them back. Many believe that is going to be incredibly difficult, and that what's going to happen is hardened de facto partition lines.
And this may be a turning point in history, in the sense that because the U.S. didn't make a hard agreement when there were forces on the ground in Anbar and then withdrew because the Iranians said, no, you can't stay. Now, if there is an alliance with Iran, we're the small seat at the table. We're not the big seat at the table. Iran is calling the shots here, right?
Well, you know, let's face it, Iran has the most influence with Nouri al-Maliki. That's absolutely for sure. We understand from reporting that Maliki asked the United States for airstrikes and all sorts of advanced weapons over the last several weeks and months when it was clear that ISIS was gaining a foothold. And that was basically denied. But, John, people have to understand that unless the swamp in Syria is drained, this is not going to have a chance in hell of succeeding in Iraq. Any attempt to push back what's happened in Iraq will simply keep getting bolstered from Syria. This is a very, very dangerous, world-shattering situation. I'm not going to say it's global World War III, but in that area, in the Iraq, Syria, and possibly, you know, shattering the stability of Lebanon and other surrounding countries, this could be a very, very dangerous thing. One official said to me, this reminds him of what happened in Afghanistan in 1994, when the Taliban swept up in a surprise move from Pakistan and simply kept pushing until they held the majority of the country and until finally they held the whole country. Then what happened there? It was the incubator for al-Qaeda. These people, ISIS, are even worse than al-Qaeda. They have splintered off from al-Qaeda because they don't think al-Qaeda is radical and brutal enough. This is a very dramatic situation, and a lot of it has been enabled by letting Syria fester like this over these last few years.
Christian Amanpour, chief international correspondent for CNN and host of Amanpour. Christian, thanks as always.
Thank you, John.
And now let's bring in Kenneth Pollack, former CIA intelligence analyst. He served on the National Security Council and is now at the Brookings Institution. Welcome to the program, Ken.
Thanks very much for having me.
One of the scenarios on the table here seems to me among the grimmest ironies in this whole affair right now, that the U.S. would ally with Iran to possibly push back the Sunni forces pushing south. What do you think of that?
Well, at some level, I think it's probably going to be necessary because at the end of the day, Iraq is in extremely dire straits. We need to get the situation stabilized, and that's going to require getting any help that we possibly can. And at the end of the day, we and the Iranians do have some similar interests in Iraq. We both want it stabilized. But we've got to remember that beyond that, you know, very narrow set of interests that we do share, we also have some very big differences about where we'd like to see Iraq go.
But yet this would be another step elevating Iran into a regional power, even beyond which they achieved after the end of combat hostilities. I don't know what that even means anymore in the Iraq invasion.
Right. Well, unfortunately, this is the reality that we face. Given the way that the United States has handled Iraq, we have effectively ceded the playing field to the Iranians. And we now have to recognize the reality that as we pulled back, as we disengaged, they moved in.
I was looking back at some of the history of Nouri al-Maliki's ascension as president, and it seems on some level he was handpicked, almost pulled out of a deck, almost at random by U.S. policymakers. Can you give us a sense of where Nouri al-Maliki came from? Certainly it was well understood that he was a Shiite, and it was well understood that he wasn't necessarily a unifier, but he really seems to have engineered this sectarian fracture.
Yeah, you know, I think when this is all said and done, that history is going to be a fascinating one for a lot of people, because you're absolutely right. What happened was that in 2005, the militias were largely in charge in Baghdad, and the United States was trying desperately to find someone who wouldn't be too divisive. And we hit upon Nouri al-Maliki simply because he was an unknown quantity. He was kind of a nothing. He was a mid-level official in one of the smaller Shia parties. And the assumption was that this guy wasn't threatening to anyone. And that's why he got to be prime minister. And, you know, we have to say that early on, Maliki didn't do badly. I mean, let's remember that in 2007, 2008, with a tremendous amount of American prodding, and that's being very kind, he did kind of rise above his kind of narrow Shia background, and he became something of a national unifying figure. After that, he then kind of devolved back to his origins. He's someone who's deeply suspicious of Sunni. He sees every Sunni as an old Ba'athist. And what we saw, especially after the American troops withdrew, was he acted in a kind of paranoid fashion to go after any of his rivals, many times in a very unconstitutional fashion. And that kind of split the Iraq that he had helped to start unify. But, you know, what you find is that when you've got a security vacuum, when you've got a kind of a nasty sectarian dictator, which unfortunately is what Nouri al-Maliki has become, it becomes almost impossible to keep a country like this together.
Finally, Ken, you supported the Iraq invasion in 2003. Would you support it again today?
Yeah, well, first of all, John, what I'd say is I supported an invasion in 2003. I did not support the one that George Bush launched. And I warned at the time that the way that the Bush administration was conducting it was, and my exact words were, going to create as many problems as it solved. And I said it was going to push the country into chaos, warlordism, and civil war. And I specifically said we should not be doing it under those circumstances. Well, that's what we did.
Kenneth Pollack, former CIA intelligence analyst. He served on the National Security Council and is now at the Brookings Institution. Ken, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on, John.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.